Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, December 31st, 2002. Today's session is Peace is the Way, Session 5, Peace in the World, an invitation to the journey from unlimited relation to unlimited love in the context of our current global crisis, presented by Joyce Holliday and Mary Emily Wells. Let's listen in.
You know, preserve the symbolism of the towers, and you know, I mean, how poignant that the towers of our own making were the targets of the terrorism, because indeed they're the symbols of the globalism, globalization that is keeping so many people exploited and oppressed. I mentioned Clarence Jordan last night, and I want to just lay out one of his other concepts that has really meant a lot to me, and then I'm going to turn it over to Emily, because we wanted to have a lot of time in this session particularly to talk about feelings around the war and strategies around the war. Clarence Jordan talked, who is a, for those of you who may not know him, was a Southern Baptist pastor who was known for two things. One was that he wrote the Cotton Patch version of the Gospels, in which he took the story of Jesus and kind of set it into modern-day Georgia. And the second was that he was one of the founders of Koinonia Farm, which was an interracial experiment of the kingdom, an experiment plot for the kingdom, I think is what he called it, where people lived together in intentional community, and they brought upon themselves the wrath of their neighbors because of their equipment, their commitment to equality between the races. One of the things that Clarence wrote about in commenting on the scripture that we read in the previous session about love your enemies was this movement of humanity. In the initial days of civilization, it was all about unlimited retaliation. And, you know, if somebody killed your ox, you could then kill their ox and their mule, and then they could respond by killing your ox and your mule and your child, or, you know, and so there was just this spiral of violence, which we see in a lot of places. Then there was a movement to limited retaliation. That's what an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was all about. That was actually put in place as a more humane way to respond to conflicts among people. You know, if somebody knocked out your eye, all you could do in response was knock out their eye. You couldn't also knock out their tooth. You were limited by retaliating only to the degree that you yourself had been violated. But that wasn't really working out so well either, so there was a movement toward limited love. And that's the, you have heard it was said, love your neighbors but hate your enemies. It was a kind of double standard that you could deal with the people, you know, fellow Jews, people who were part of your community, in one way, and with a spirit of love. But, you know, it was really okay to hate the outsiders, hate the enemies, and treat them differently. But what the life of Jesus was about was unlimited love, this sense that you don't draw the boundaries anywhere, you don't define enemies over here and neighbors over here and treat people differently, but that our invitation is to, through Christ, a universal love for all people, an unlimited kind of love, which of course was symbolized for us on the cross, that absolute surrender and pouring out. And so I would like to hear us, after Emily's poem, just talk a little bit about, you know, I mean, it sounds so impractical, and as Clarence Jordan himself says, it's totally impractical. You know, if you're going to approach the world through unlimited love because you think you're going to be treated well in response, it's not, you know, it's not going to work. And we have the model of Jesus to show us that. But if indeed we accept that this is the call on our life as Christians, how do we, you know, take that not only into our personal relationships, but how do we respond to the international situation that we find ourselves in at this moment? I mean, literally on the verge, I think Bush has been saying, sometime after January 1st, it's all going to come down, and that's tomorrow. So Emily's got a poem for us, and then we'll take some time to talk to her.
This poem is from a collection by Wendell Berry called A Timbered Choir. These are poems. He takes a walk every Sunday morning, so these are his Sabbath poems. written in 1991. The year begins with war. Our bombs fall day and night, hour after hour, by death a prod appeasing wrath, folly, and greed at home. Upon our giddy tower, we'd oversway the world. Our hate comes down to kill those whom we do not see, for we have given up our sight to those in power and to machines, and now are blind to all the world. This is a nation where no lovely thing can last. We trample, gouge, and blast. The people leave the land. The land flows to the sea. Fine men and women die. The fine old houses fall. The fine old trees come down. Highway and shopping mall still guarantee the right and liberty to be a peaceful murderer, a murderous worshiper, a slender glutton. Forgiving no enemy, forgiven by none, we live the death of liberty, become what we have feared to be. At our first session, in the introduction, I read a poem by Denise Levertov, which talked about constructing peace the way you would construct a poem, word by word, phrase by phrase. And there's a challenge in that poem for us, I think. She says, what would happen if you reconstructed the sentence our lives are making? I'd like to invite us into a conversation about what this sentence is our lives are making, what this bit of history is that our nation is continuing to build. And this poem begins, the year begins with war. It's a fine way to, I think that pretty much sums up where we are today in our nation. But I challenge us to think about how we will begin our year. What will your year begin with? The nation's year begins with war. That's seeming sort of set now. I hate the word inevitable, but it's the way we're headed, right? How will your year begin? What choices will you make? What towers will you refuse to build? What towers will you deconstruct? How will you reconstruct the life or the sentence your life is making? Might as well think for a minute and then share and encourage one another. Throw out ideas. Denise Levertov talks about how peace isn't there until the words are spoken. So throw them out, you know? It may seem crazy, it may be foolish, but grace is foolish in some sense. Love is foolish. Loving your enemies is foolish. Let's just try it out. Let's say these things to one another, things we maybe won't dare to actually do, but there's no chance we would do them or shape our lives by them until we have spoken them out loud to one another.
Throw, and it's also okay to just talk about how you feel about it, and not necessarily what you're going to do, because that, I think it's hard to know what to do. I'm hoping to get some ideas from all of you, but I think I'm still reeling with how I feel about it, and so it's hard to get to what you do about it.
I think one thing that I would like to try and do in next year, and unfortunately it's going to have to be after I leave here because we do so much of it up here, is to not build anything new. It's a pretty telling statistic that the new house building in the country is at the all-time high in the last few months, and we're still constructing brand new things. It's at the fastest rate ever. And it's a problem that I see, and I see it up here. I see the things that we do, the way we justify why we need to do new things constantly. Mm-hmm. I think that would go, for me personally, a long way towards reducing my consumption of things.
Used cars and new cars, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that there are certain economic views that suggest that more consumption is better for the economy. Mm-hmm. That's a good thing. My wife and I kind of had a similar little New Year's resolution before we came here. We've got some frozen foods, and I dehydrate foods and such, and we find ourselves going out to restaurants a lot and stuff like that. So it's kind of like use what we have and try not to, use up more resources that you know. The thing that I plan to take the vow of nonviolence, and mm-hmm. this is to help me. In reading the vow, these are things that I've over the past few years have brought into my have valued and have been very aware of. I've been attending a Mennonite church, and there's a very strong a peace stance within that denomination. And the vow for me will be help me to be more conscious in my everyday, what I do on a more daily basis. That often, going to a service, you read all these things, and you reaffirm it on Sunday. But how do you bring that every day in your life? I think the vow will help me with that aspect of it, and it also makes it feel more serious an endeavor in my life. It makes it a little bit more. Frightening an aspect that I really need to adjust my some of my my life way and my lifestyle. So just a little personal sharing on what. And so yeah, the feelings around that are encouragement, encouragement for a sense of hope. And also a bit of a sense of nervousness around it, a little sense of but that helps the adrenaline, that helps the motivation for it. That's all.
I'm struggling with what we're doing in Iraq. This is my second session, so maybe you guys have talked about these things, but pertinent to the international view. I come from a world view. At the age of 11, we moved overseas, and I spent time in Japan, Hong Kong, and the Philippines during the Vietnam War, and was obviously shaped by that. But what I saw in our travels through Africa and some of the third world countries is the hope that our country is given the rest of the world. So I come to this session very differently than probably many of you come from it. And I really believe that our country created a new paradigm as far as governance before our country started. We had emperors and kings and totalitarian leaders, and our experiment in self-governance has given a lot of the rest of the world hope. So I'm trying to see your side here, because I believe after December 8th where Saddam Hussein provided us, and this is very, this is a very specific, but maybe I'll give you a glimpse of where I'm at, provided us basically the same documentation he gave us in 1996, with no evidence of where the nuclear materials that were used to create a nuclear weapon and some of the other biological materials, where that went. And the inspectors that are there now are not there to prove that he doesn't have it. He's supposed to prove that he doesn't have it. They're there just to verify. This whole thing's gotten twisted where now it's up to the UN to prove that he doesn't have it. How can you prove that? You know, it's something you can't prove. And after the December 8th documentation with all the holes in it and virtually nothing different, I don't know that we have any alternative but to go in before there's a nuclear weapon that could be used against Israel or against his neighbors and do something. But as a Christian, I'm struggling with the concept of a just war. You know, I believe that there is evil in the world and that as Christians we should stand for what's good and coming supporting people that are being oppressed by evil. But so I'm struggling with maybe understanding the position that we can't or we shouldn't. And I'm here because I'm listening for the Word of God in our talking and hopefully providing some discernment. So you said just talk. I don't have any conclusions. I'm just sharing my struggle.
So. I think we've always lived with that hope that you talk about here in this country until the office of the presidency started to deteriorate. And in my lifetime, that started with Nixon and then through Clinton. And I think that is reflected around the world in how they view this country. At the same time, the corporations, particularly the multinationals, have gotten so much more powerful that they have, as representative of this country, trashed this country in their daily life. So I don't know that I carry that hopeful view that the other world has for us so much now as I did 20 years ago. The other thing is that we have made a strong case over our history of not being those other people. We were set apart. Mm-hmm. And I see us now being those people. We are the enemy. We are acting like that with this, the concept of going in the first strike. We have no business, I think, with a first strike. If Iraq wants to build war, there are things that we can do about that. But to go in and bomb them, I think, is wrong.
One thing that has really troubled me about, you know, within the liberal Protestant Christian community, usually clergy talking with clergy and church offices talking among themselves, and we're all throwing the just war theory around. And the just war theory can really be used, I mean, as it stands, it can be used both ways. One thing that really troubles me about the just war theory, and I won't take time to list its provisions, but one thing that is entirely missing from just war theory is a recognition of the enormous power differentials that can exist between a country like the United States and anyone else in the world. It treats all nations as being basically the same, but what if one nation has six times the military budget of Iraq, China, Syria, Israel, Russia combined? Does that color the moral conversation at all? It has always seemed to me that it's incumbent upon the person who has the power to make the peace. That if you have all of this wealth and power, you have to be able to absorb a certain amount of violence without retaliation, simply because that power and wealth is going to attract violence. And you're the big brother. if you have the power, you have to be the one not to retaliate, because you have security in all of this military force and all of this wealth. You can stand to lose a little bit for the sake of the sake of peace. Yeah. When was our last diplomatic contact with Iraq? Formal diplomatic contact. It has all been sanctions and violence for the last decade.
Mm-hmm. And I think the reality is that we don't have the security. I mean, you said we have the security in the military, but, you know, what September 11th was about, and this whole, you know, everything that's gone on since, is that there is no security. I mean, going back to the previous conversation, how different it would be if on some kind of international level we managed to figure out putting the person in the hut and going, some of you I know weren't part of this, but yeah, and going by and saying everything that was good and trying to restore. You know, what if we put, I don't know the latest figure, but I heard it was going to be $32 billion or something to carry out this war. What if we put $32 billion into building schools and hospitals in Iraq? Or, you know, I mean, what if we just totally opened up the conversation to some totally different thing other than saying, you know, the only way to contain them is to bomb their children, which is really what we're saying, you know, and then you get into a kind of putting a moral, I mean, that their children's lives aren't worth more, you know, if we're saving some lives in Israel by killing their children, is that, you know, is that really okay? Is it okay that we killed, I mean, you know, I think this nation keeps forgetting that there is only one nation in the history of the world that has ever actually used a nuclear weapon. Close to 1 million Japanese, I think, killed. And, you know, the justification was always, you know, but think of all the American lives that we saved because we didn't, you know, out there in the Pacific Theater, our soldiers didn't, yeah. But then you're getting into this, you know, putting a moral value on the lives of some people versus other people. You know, and is that a Christian way to look at caring more, really?
Yeah, that conflict is still going on with Kissinger. His conversations with some of the Europeans to accept a truce in Vietnam was to put off that war 3 years, 3.5 years more. We lost a huge number of people because mm-hmm. of his diplomatic efforts. Mm-hmm. At least that's what one side says.
I'm worried when we kind of breath about Saddam Hussein too. I remember during reading about World War II, some of the progressive Christians in Germany I think Bonhoeffer would talk about how can we solve, quote, the Jewish problem. Their language and their thoughts have been co-opted by the government's creation of this crisis. And I heard Dick Cheney wanted to bomb Iraq like 2.5 hours after the World Trade Centers came down. And what has precipitated this? What is it really? Why are we suddenly so concerned about mm-hmm. Iraq's weapons of mass destruction, which we can't find? There have been a lot of meetings with the oil companies, and not just in Iraq, but in Colombia, where the war on terror is also going. And sometimes I think we can become these paranoid, you know, conspiracy theorists, but I think we also have to be realistic that what is this great threat that, why suddenly, is it really $32 billion worth of threat that we're scared of, or is there something else going on?
I think that one of the things that might become interesting in the next few years is the way that we justify war. The war in 91 was very much justified by an invasion into Kuwait, and then a dictator propped up as evil and shown to be the worst and rallied support behind our invasion and our battle in that region because of this against evil notion. And slowly this is starting to change, and it's being tried out now by, you know, for the first time, fairly blatantly, a bunch of money has been given to Colombia to protect the pipeline, not to fight drugs, not to fight some evil, but to say, okay, this is protecting our interest. I wouldn't be very surprised if in a very short period of time, because of American lifestyle, you can have a president or a group of people claim that we need to go to war to protect our interests in oil, in whatever it would happen to be at the time. And we might see this idea of evil go away. Someone stop using this kind of big branded name and using instead, well, we have to do this to continue our lifestyle. This is, protects our interests, makes our lives the way it is. We have to keep consuming, and so the way we have to keep doing this is to go and make sure we can get oil from this place and oil from this place. And that's a pretty dramatic change, and it's seen in the First Strike Initiative that the president, you know, amazing latent words to say out loud by anyone, especially the president of the United States. And that's where it's headed to. It's headed to not, we don't have to combat something, we now have to go first and make sure that we have what we need to get first. And so when we talk about, some of my problems with our conversations about war and how everyone, we kind of all get up in arms about we shouldn't go to war, is that it misses the larger picture. It's a nice focus for us to go into, we can now chant and we don't need to go to war, we can't do this, we shouldn't kill people, without acknowledging and kind of sidestepping the issue that every day, by the way all of us in our society live, we kill people. And that's the bigger question. How do we change our society so that in our lives we are not causing the deaths of others and suffering of others? And the war, it's not a big deal. Like, we're going to go to war and we're going to bomb Iraq and we're going to kill a bunch of people. It's a pretty small fraction of the people that we, as a nation, as a society, as a Western civilization, kill on a yearly basis.
I think that's what we were talking about last session, was the amazement that we have when people are able to be in community with their enemies and not be transformed by them. That the guy whose arms were blown off, realizing that his bitterness, initial bitterness, was in fact the end result that his enemies had hoped in planting this letter bomb, and then deciding to not become cynical and angry, to not let his life be taken from him, but to choose to be hopeful. The same with Tutu, I think what has happened for many of us is that we have let it become overwhelming, and we become a little cynical about it. Our anger forces itself in ways that actually protect us from having to take any action or do anything, because it's too big, it's too frustrating, I get too pissed off, you know. And the dilemma would be, I believe, to have some heroes and to continue to see that it's possible, actually, in our own communities, in our hearts, in our communities, in our actions every day, to be heroic. Not just, you know, kind of things that are private, the things that are public, and give hope to others. I guess that's what we want to do this session, is to figure some of that stuff out. You know, I was just thinking, the first thing I thought, and it was too ridiculous, was wouldn't it be awesome if everybody who had SUVs would just drive them out on the freeways and, you know, cut the engine and walk away? And say, we don't want a war for this. We don't want to kill people for these fucking cars. You know, stop killing people for our cars. We don't want it. You know, it'd be awesome. It'd be really, I mean, you know, it would never happen, but that's, I mean, that's what was so cool about, what was that crazy book which you ran the film backwards with the bombs? The bombs were, they came out of the land. What was that?
Is that Slaughterhouse 5?
Slaughterhouse 5, yeah. By Vonnegut, somebody ran a film backwards, which was about the bombing of Dresden. And what happened was that all of a sudden you saw, how did it go?
Rubble gathering together in fiery balls and becoming buildings.
Yeah, and these things, these containers that had all the evil in them coming up into these planes that took them away back into the United States, and these ships, and these women in these factories taking all this evil stuff and putting it back in the ground, deep in the ground, where nobody can get to it again. I mean, it's really interesting. And that was his the brilliance of Vonnegut was, you know, someone who came out of Dresden, for Christ's sake. You know, to say that there is a way to image this, that is hope providing. And he was an absurdist, you know, in some ways. But still, he did something important. And I think it's possible to be an absurdist. I don't think we have to. I mean, cynicism is just the other side of hilarity in some ways. You're just like, you know, it's too big. And that is kind of a joke, because it's never too big. But.
And I think the biggest thing we're lacking in all this is imagination, like on all sides, too.
Exactly.
Imagine something other than, let's just go bomb the hell out of them because they might be threatening to us, you know?
Yeah, and because Bush has all the power, and he's an idiot. You know, we don't have to, like, be subservient to that. There are ways to get past that, but the funnier our response would be, the more likely to succeed. I mean, if we take Bush seriously, we'll always lose. Because that's how he operates. He's like a big brother who, like, smacks you down every time you have a you know, you try something.
I'm really looking for a profound act of imagination, a vision that could help me in my community, because where I live, I'm surrounded by people that most of us in this room would view as an enemy of sorts right now, because in my community, there's no question that you get behind the war, because that's what a Republican does, and there's just no question about it.
Patriot does.
Yeah. Well. But it's assumed that us means we're all Republicans here, ranchers and farmers, and I was thinking about that poem that you read, Mary, and also thinking about something Martin Luther wrote. Early in his reforming career, cursed be the prophet who says peace, peace where there is no peace. And Barry's poem was not very peaceful at all. But I've been thinking about ways of approaching this war in my community. If I'm struggling against the people, it just builds walls and we're not having a conversation anymore. I've been playing with the idea that Christ's way is to suffer publicly about it. Is there a way that I can take the suffering of the war into my own person and live with it publicly? Not as someone who's fighting against the war, because that won't work where I'm at, but someone who is suffering because of the war, and make that visible at all times. That could that public suffering be redemptive in any way?
It may not be recognized by your community as Jesus's. Wasn't in his community. I'm thinking of the example that someone brought up with Jeremiah buying the plot of ground. It seemed like he was yelling, peace, peace, in time of war.
Eric, do you have a vision for what that might look like? I'm trying to imagine what you're imagining, or even possibilities.
No, I've got the abstract, and I haven't come to a minute particular yet.
Doesn't it really the biggest thing mean to get rid of some of our comfort? I mean, Thoreau's talking about the only place for a just man in this society is in prison. Isn't that what we're all trying to say? That, I mean, if we actually all want to do something about this instead of have our conversation, don't we all pretty much need to get jailed or go out on the streets and do something? I mean, if that's the truth of it, whether we can, either I personally have the ability to do that or not is a big question, but that's the fact of the matter. If we actually want to do something to change the society we live in, we have to do something that is public, often seen as violent by other people, and causes us to suffer. There's no redemption in suffering if it doesn't actually cause us to suffer. There's no change that is going to happen unless you actually suffer to do it. You can keep hope through that. That's the ultimate paradox. But can you commit to not only just saying, okay, I'll take a vow of nonviolence, but I will be proactive in my suffering to make myself sacrifice the things that I take for granted in this world?
I think that's somewhat heroic, but I think that it's predefining what your experience is going to be like instead of being open to the spirit. Because in fact, some people would say Thoreau would even say that the reason that the good people are in prison is because there's a joy in being just. There's this sense of final relief. God, I'm finally not standing with the oppressor. You know, that's great. I feel great today. Mm-hmm. You know, so then the suffering becomes an oddity, You can even imagine Jesus saying, "Well, I'm doing my Father's will. Glad this is close to conclusion because it's pretty painful." But there's a sense in which, what was Jesus saying apparently on the cross? You know, forgive these people because they don't know what the hell they're doing. There's some incredible heroic brilliance about that, which is desirous. If we could somehow articulate the opposition as being exciting and community building and humanizing and relief bringing.
Somebody said, somebody was giving a talk, and they were saying that these are times that are pregnant with potential, and that there's a whole new, insight in this time, the age of Aquarius, and we're recycling and we're becoming more aware of it. And somebody in the audience said, if that's true, I think there's more weaponry now. I think there's more deaths due to violence. I think there's more wars. And why would that be if these are times of enlightenment and these are times of... And she said, the answer I thought was good. She said that war is really amazingly cathartic. It's very exciting. Violence is pretty stimulating. And that if you're not on a spiritual path, if you're not on a true spiritual path, not a religious path, but if you're really on the feeling the excitement and the incredible exhilaration of what we're talking about when we're talking about some of these gospels and talking about Christ saying, all things I do, you will do and more. The kingdom of God is within you. And have that type of exhilaration happening, then you'll go towards this other stuff. And that's why we go towards it, because we have such a spiritually... there was a lot of religion happening. I've spent time in a lot of countries, and the Christian movement in this country in some ways seems to mirror that. But we're missing that. And I'm thinking that, these discussions about our government and what we're doing, it's no different than any other time when someone's taken power. Napoleonic Wars or what happened with Stalin and World War II, any of them, when they get to the point when power and comfort becomes the way we have it, it just brings with it all these other things, which I, the more I have, the more I can lose. And the more violent I'll be to keep you from taking it, etc., and the more I'll set up preemptive things so you won't get it. Mm-hmm. So it's not for me... is it okay to do what we're doing? To me, it's just a foregone conclusion that we are as corrupt and as dangerous and violent as any other organization became extremely powerful and out of balance within the rest of the world. And what we're going to do, maybe we won't do Iraq, but we're on that way. The Scott Ritter film the other night, with where we're going with the new American legacy to be preemptive in the world. Set up. We probably are on that course. So That being the case, at least for me, that seems that's happening. We are as corrupt and as destructive as Napoleon was, but with much, much more destructive power. In answer to your question, Joyce, my feeling is that, my fear is that they'll grow more angry, more depressed, mm-hmm. despairing, as we go into Iraq, which more than likely is going to happen. And those of us that have been in Central America and seen what we've done before, we know that we've been doing this for, we did it all through Vietnam, we did it through all Latin America. We just do it, because we have to, when you got that much. In order to deal with it, there has to be a really strong spiritual thing happening. Mm-hmm. And realize that maybe we're only here not to succeed and change this, but to realize that on Earth, you deal with unsolvable problems like countries like this that do things like we do. And you're only here to pass the lesson of not becoming despairing, not to give up faith, not to give up hope, to continue to try, like Mother Teresa said, and don't think that success is possibly part of the equation, because there may be no success whatsoever. Mm-hmm. So, I'm sorry to be long-winded, but I'm kind of just percolating as a...
I keep going back to the question that Eric was asking about just how can we, you know, make the suffering real. And I think part of the reason that it's been so easy to move forward on this whole path towards war is that it's really hard for most Americans to have any kind of a realistic picture about the suffering that the Iraqi people will be under. I think that the war is a very abstract thing, and as you were saying, it's kind of a glamorous thing, you know? And that I think the suffering of the Iraqi people, you know, the suffering that they've been undergoing already under the sanctions, between 500,000 and 1,000,000 people have died in Iraq because of the sanctions already. Now we're talking about a war in which many more innocent people will die because of the decisions of their, you know, one person, their leader, who they don't seem to have a lot of control to elect, even though they did elect him by 100% in the last election. but it just seems like one of the ways for me that's, or one of the things for me that's been helpful to really, you know, to make it clear why opposition to the war is essential is in learning more about the people of Iraq. We've been fortunate that we had a couple of friends. Well, Peter Thompson, who was a member of this community last winter, and Steve Clemens went to Iraq with Voices in the Wilderness, and were there for 2 weeks, and wrote back about their interactions with ordinary people and, you know, the lives that they're living and how difficult their lives are even now. And just, you know, kind of projecting how much more difficult their lives will be in a war. And I wonder if there are ways that we can do a better job of corresponding with the people of Iraq. You know, maybe it doesn't mean going to Iraq and visiting there, but can we, you know, establish pen pal relationship or, you know, something with people of Iraq? Are there ways that we can get reports back from these Voices in the Wilderness trips that are going over there and share those with our friends, our neighbors, to help the people that we interact with, to help them realize that this war is not just going to, you know, affect Saddam Hussein. It's going to affect millions of innocent Iraqi people, and that a lot of innocent people are going to die. Mm-hmm. You know?
And probably Saddam will survive.
Yeah.
Now, how do we take that further? And we can start a nice leather campaign. We can start changing people's minds of people like ourselves who are comfortable. And we can start thinking about suffering other people and getting to know the average Iraqi and understanding how the war will affect them. How do you take that even a step further and transform it into the minds of a large portion of American society that struggles through a daily basis to just make ends meet, works multiple jobs under terrible conditions, that raises their children in an increasingly violent society? How do you make them care at all about the suffering of bombs being dropped somewhere else when the message is that their lives will improve because of this? Mm-hmm. And that's why it's being so. It's one of the reasons it's going to be sold more and more that way. Is it's your life will become better if there is guaranteed resources in this way.
Well, people that are in support of of action are perhaps more idealistic than you think. We truly have a love for the Iraqi people, and we see them in under the rule of an oppressive ruler, and that if we could eliminate Saddam Hussein from power, that they have hope, and that their lives would improve. And there is a certain disconnect in that with regard to the from here to there, perhaps, that I think we're speaking to here far more articulately about the process of getting from here to there and the lives that may be lost from here to there. But the goal, I think if you truly love the Iraqi people, is you'd want to see them in, under a better government, with more freedoms, and you know, self-determination, maybe not, I don't know. But that's where I sit with my hopes, and maybe I'm too idealistic in my view of the process of getting from here to there. But I see reports about Saddam Hussein watching the torture videos of his son-in-law before they killed him, that defected, and him in a council taking a gun out and shooting one of his advisors, and you know the kind of just evil man that he is, and the results of the sanctions. Primarily, you know, the humanitarian aid is not getting to the people; it's getting to the army. It's getting, I mean, like happens in any situation like this, the people don't actually get what the aid that we're trying to give them. And I just think that we need to, I truly believe if we love the people, we need to somehow help them. And by inaction and letting this regime continue, that's not helping them. And that's the struggle that I have. But I don't, I share the pain and that's the part that I'm struggling with, the here to there. But the goal of them being liberated, I think, is a just and noble one. And I just had to share that, because I am in opposition. Some of the people here speaking to the opposition.
And I want to say that I value that. I think a lot of times at Holden, I've been coming here all my life, and a lot of times it's really good for me to get pumped up by people who think just like I do, and I'd love to have somebody who has a little different twist on it, and I value that you're speaking that, and you're giving me a different way to think, and I'm grateful to you for that.
But, yeah, I mean, I go along with the idea that getting rid of Saddam Hussein and changing the government there would be really good for the people and so on. I mean, it gets down to a question how to bring that about and whether a war and the violence that causes that and the repercussions of having a war, is that going to be the best way to bring about a change in the government there and to get rid of him there? And I've been reading articles lately about talking about even our recent history in the last several decades and so on, about the number of cases where terribly oppressive regimes and dictators and so on have been overcome by not entirely nonviolent, but I mean a lot less violent ways than a war and so on like that. And it seems like the number of examples that we've had of that occurring over recent decades would lead us to think that that is a more successful way to get something like this to come about rather than invading the country and having a war. So, I go along with the objective a whole lot. It's just the means to bring that about, I think, is really very faulty with our government's policy.
What are some of the examples, just for my, after this, I'd like to go and read about that for my own.
Well, Marcos in the Philippines. Okay. Just the whole the coup in Russia, where the repressive forces were trying to take back the government there, and essentially a lot of populist opposition to that prevented it from occurring.
British Empire out of India.
Yeah, there's a few recent articles in Sojourners magazine there that I would just go over and read some of those. I mean, they do a better job describing, I think, than I could.
Because the way where I come is We look at the sanctions and how many thousands of children have died as a result of our sanctions and the prolonged diplomatic process. Whereas, if we were to go in and have a short war and it's a surgical type of a activity, perhaps the number of lives that are lost would be less, getting to the same goal. But I do have, I am struggling with reconciling what you're pointing out, in my opinion. I'm not fixed.
It seems to me that, sanctions seem like a good idea right at first. You want to change the behavior of a country.
Nonviolent.
You don't want to invade them and use violence at it. And there at least have been some cases where the people or the government, kind of responds to those economic pressures and so on. It didn't work here, and it became fairly clear within a year or two that this wasn't going to work. And then I think that's where the evil came of it and so on, is that continuing to pursue a policy that isn't working, has really no prospect of working.
And politically, to try to change that would be suicide. I mean, once you realize that, you don't have the will to change it.
Right. That was,
but we also
that was
changed,
our,
in this country, we changed government.
Correct.
We changed it to Clinton.
Yeah.
And then Clinton went on and tried to do a surgical strike 4 different times and failed each one of them.
Yeah.
So now we've changed governments again.
But Clinton's surgical strike was, it was not a surgical strike. It was a political, there was no...
Yeah, it was a PR move.
It was a PR process. It wasn't,
I don't think it had really any good chance of success.
But part of the problem in this country is that we change our leaders and therefore our foreign policy relatively often.
It's a problem, but it's also a good thing. Mm-hmm.
One could look at that. I mean, it's certainly different
than
a monarch who stays in power for 20 years, where you have a continuous policy.
There's certain pragmatic downsides to that.
Well, surely doesn't make it easier to, try to work with our government policy in the UN and so on like that, because I think in contrast to Mary Emily's view here, there's still a bunch of us who are out to try to influence policy and in the hopes of either affecting what kind of military action is taken or even deferring it based on, maybe the right kind of strategy working out in connection working with the UN and so on like that. But in my neighborhood or my town, there's just a whole lot of things going on where folks are still really, really quite actively trying to influence things. And they did another poll that the newspaper published on Christmas Eve in Seattle there, saying that now the majority of the people living in Seattle are opposed to the war. And this has been a trend moving towards that for a number of months. And I don't think at the end of the summer, though, that there was nearly as much recognition and feeling like that against the war, but it's because of the number of activities that have been occurring in the fall and are continuing to occur that the acceptance, it's okay to think, be against the war. I mean, it's not everyone, the Republican view there and so on. You hear people talking in contrasting views, and you start to think about it, and you think, well, okay, it's okay for me to think like this too. And I think that's been building up as there's been more talk and activity going on. And I try to stay in touch with this, but it's kind of hard to get all the information and keep up with what's going on there. This evening, at Green Lake in Seattle and at Berg Place in Ballard there are going to be peace vigils. People have been getting together every week at Berg Place in Ballard all fall to have an hour-long peace vigil. And they've increased in numbers from a handful up to about 40 people a week are meeting there and so on. Then tomorrow they're going to meet up at the high school at noon and have a walk through Ballard there again, just recognition to see people to be in presence there on that. And just the continued, there's going to be forums with cumbersome McDermott and a guy.
Bert Sykes.
Bert
Sykes.
Bert Sykes. Over at, well, first one on Thursday night over at Central Lutheran in Seattle, and then they're going to be up at Trinity United Methodist in Ballard on Friday night, again, talking about the sanctions and a lot of the themes that we're talking about here. So, and then we got activities planned in the middle of the month, too, that there's a fellow who is, or a campaign getting going there to have a 1,000 potlucks for peace on January 18th. And this is an idea of trying to get together a small group of folks just in your neighborhood here again to talk and relate about these problems and issues. This is, it's cited here is that a fellow in our neighborhood started picking apples off of his apple tree and set up his cider press on a Saturday afternoon. And I can't remember exactly what they called it. I guess they were calling it Cider Press for Peace. And they set it up to attract, you know, folks in the neighborhood came by there. And again, it was just a very casual get-together there where they talked about just how they felt about it right in their community. And I think it might be the same guy then this is kind of working on these potlucks in January here. And they tied together the Martin Luther King March on Martin Luther King Day with an anti-war theme, and the anti-war groups and the civil rights groups are kind of tied together there and are talking a lot about Martin Luther King Jr.'s opposition to the war and his advocacy of nonviolence there. So I mean, there's all these things going on, and I guess the idea is that that as things develop with the UN inspections and things going on in January, the reports coming back in there and so on, that if there can be enough talk about this and so on, it will have some influence on the Bush administration. I sort of think that the Bush administration had a much harder position on it on things in August and September like that, and that they've been forced to, sort of work more through the UN and give chance to wait for the UN just because of the speaking up and the public opposition to the policy that came up in the fall there. So I kind of look at, we still have some chance, as things break to try to influence the policy for peace here and stuff with a lot of these, kind of small activities going on as well as citywide or the national efforts to get a lot of publicity as well. They're also getting organized in Seattle, and I think nationally too, for activities right around when the hostilities break out, if they do, and they have announced plans for what's going to happen the day that the hostilities break out and for the day after on that as well.
My thought though is that the activism against this war is always retroactive. Every time we're fighting against a war happening, we are constantly being put in a position to counter small things, there's a very specific focus now of this war here. Mm-hmm. So no matter how much public protest you get out, no matter how much voice you get to the government saying we don't want this war in Iraq, we're getting the same exact amount, if not overwhelmingly more, public opinion saying we don't want to change our lives at the same time. We want our lives to be this way and we want them to be bigger and better constantly. There hasn't been any movement in the society that talks about that in a large way. And so no matter how much we talk about bombing Iraq is a bad idea, the president gets the message that the lifestyle that we all have wants to be continued. And the best way to continue that lifestyle is to bomb Iraq. And so I think we have to shift focus away from, we need to constantly concentrate on talking about the war and other things as well. But the focus, the bigger issue has got to be addressed, and that's how we have society lives.
And in fact, the war, the focus on the war and the media is, the media's use of that, it draws attention away from our real motives for going to war like that. I think that's one of the problems with the argument or the perspective that we are doing a good thing for these countries that were liberating their oppressive leadership, we tend to think of ourselves as, you know, the saviors. But down deep, if what we're doing is we're avoiding or we're not recognizing the underlying motives, why we're really going, you know, into Iraq, and then covering it with this feeling of, oh, well, you know, we're doing a good thing here, you know. So we feel good about it. But I think we need to feel, remorse and for the, you know, the oppressive structures and are part of them, and we need to dig more deeply into that. And so perhaps it's true that the focus on the war and these little things tend to direct our attention away from, our intentions, our motives, what's driving how fear is a factor, how greed is a factor, and our action, and actions in the world, and we tend to deny that more.
If Iraq's primary export were broccoli, would any of this be happening? And that's what, that question causes me to question altruistic motives that get voiced. There are lots of so-called evil dictators in the world, lots of real repressive countries, and they get no attention at all.
I'm picturing huge warning labels, to be placed on all gas pumps. Warning, refueling your car may cause deaths of children in Iraq. I think the first level of sort of change is always that acknowledgement. And here in the United States, I think we've lulled ourselves into this, not acknowledging that when we fill our car, the food that we buy, the clothing we wear, what is it linked to? What power do we have as individuals in the choices that we make every day? And then if we acknowledge the impact of our choice and still choose to do it, at least we're if we now pick up a cigarette and smoke it, at least we hopefully realize what we're doing to our lungs. And we're still doing that, and however that works inside someone. I don't know. So that's sort of a big image that I've been having as we've been talking this morning, is this huge warning label and how many things it would go on. The back of our car, the water pump, the shirt I got on sale made in Bangladesh, all those different things that would then cause me every day, to go, all right, look at this. Am I going to choose something different? Am I going to go, oh shit, I'm going to do it anyway? Mm-hmm. You know?
I just have to make a quick one thing that I've been thinking about as I begin the new year is that I've been looking at this vow of nonviolence for the last month or so, and I'm not sure that it fits exactly with some of the things that I believe in. We've kind of been trying to shape it a little bit differently, but I've been thinking about my new year's resolution being to every day be an instrument of peace, or I'm trying to formulate that exactly what it's going to be, but waking up every morning and thinking about, okay, how can I be a peacemaker today? And that goes in everything that I do, whether or not I shop at Walmart, or whether or not I, what food I eat, if I go to a fast food restaurant, or if I start buying organic food, or all of those things, and thinking about every little step of my day and taking it one day at a time, from the moment I walk out my door, the moment I brush my teeth in the morning, what products I'm using, where, being intentional about knowing where the stuff that I use daily comes from, and making responsible choices in purchasing those items and using them. Mm-hmm.
It is actually a little past 12, so we probably ought to go to lunch. But I do want to just encourage us in the time that we have left here, and I know for some people that's less than 24 hours, but to really get back to the question of imagination, to really begin to imagine an alternative to what's happening. Go back to what Eric was raising about what's the public vision, whether it's in a small town full of Republicans in Montana or in Seattle or wherever it is that you happen to be from, and because I don't, you know, I just don't think we've taken enough time to think with that kind of imagination, and maybe we're kind of tired, or maybe we're too cynical or whatever, but, you know, part of what I have gotten from these few days and have been anxious for is, you know, conversation around that kind of imagination. And we may even take a few minutes tomorrow in our wrap-up session. I had said earlier that we would mostly be focusing on praying around these things, but I think if there are more things that come to your imagination out of your conversations today, out of your dreaming tonight, you know, whatever, that getting some of those concrete things that we've heard some of the concretes, but, you know, if there's more, I think that would be helpful as an encouragement to all of us, a gift to all of us, that we, as we go forth from this place, you know, how is it that we wake up every day saying, I want to be an instrument of peace? You know, what does that mean? So, let's go to lunch, and we'll talk about some of that and pray tomorrow in our wrap-up session. Thank you.
Thank you.